listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Richard Mullins is going to has the honor of introducing Sapphire tonight, and I have the honor of introducing her. Bridget has taught at Harvard University and Brown University, and for 15 years she curated the reading series at Dia Art Foundation in New York. She is currently the director of the Masters in Professional Writing program at USC. She is a generous colleague and a passionate advocate for the literary arts. She is also a prize-winning playwright, and her plays have been produced in New York, London, and San Francisco. They include Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, Topographical Eden, and Pathological Venus. It is a great honor to welcome Bridget Mullins, and in turn also please welcome both of them, Bridget and Sapphire, to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Ken. It's so wonderful to be in this beautiful building with Sapphire, who I know loves libraries, and you'll hear more about that. So we first invited Sapphire to read for the Master of Professional Writing program at USC, and then we thought, why should we hog up Sapphire? Let's share her with Los Angeles. So I called Louise, who is, as ever, hip and gracious. And so, as Louise mentioned, I have the privilege to introduce Sapphire. And what I hope to do is to provide a little context, maybe some stuff you don't know. Don't worry. And then Sapphire will read some passages from Push and other things, and we'll open up the floor to your questions. So as you feel questions brewing, make note, keep them in the back of your mind, and you'll have a chance. So Sapphire, as you know, she is an award-winning poet and novelist. She's a master of her craft. In the line of Dostoevsky and Dickens, she writes about those on the margins. She writes about the dispossessed, and she gives them a voice. She does it through not only her passion for language, but through her wit and her incredible humor, the capaciousness of her imagination. Yeats describes the goal of art as being It's the desire to hold reality and justice in a single breath. And Sapphire does that. Her first book, American Dreams, was published in 1994. American Dreams is a consciously multi-genre book. It contains straight-up fiction, elegies that incorporate letters, poetry, and actual state documents. Some of the titles in that book are titles like Human Torso Gives Birth, which was an actual headline from Jet magazine. Poems of Place, Homages, Poems of Harlem. Now, one thing you might think, because she writes so exquisitely about Harlem and about New York, is you might think she's from New York, but she's California, girl. She was born in Fort Ord into a military family and moved to Los Angeles, where she lived just a few miles from here. She lived through the Watts riots. Then she left L.A. for San Francisco after that. She moved to Harlem, where she stayed for the next 15 years. She was pre-med, and she graduated with a BFA in dance and the humanities. Wow. Yeah. During her 15 years in Harlem, she worked in a variety of low-paying minimum wage jobs, and she started teaching literacy after she got her BFA in 1982. She taught GED, adult education, and ESL. In 93, she moved to Brooklyn, where she studied for her MFA in creative writing at Brooklyn College. Her next book was the culmination of these years in Harlem, Push. It was published in 96. In Push, we meet Precious Jones, and we meet this young woman, and we don't forget Precious Jones. And the film that came out of the novel is of course, the film Precious, where you meet such a soul. she asks questions like, what is a normal life? And she says, what do I want to be? By the end, she says, I want to be the queen of the ABCs. Her third book is a collection of poems. It's a very serious collection of poems. It's called Black Wings and Blind Angels. And by serious, I mean it's a serious apprenticeship to the craft of poetry. And you see this throughout Sapphire's writing. Right now, she's taking a grammar class. She's someone who really goes into the language, into the syntax, and sees how she can use it. Sorry to be saying all this in front of you. I'll just continue. I know you're here to see Sapphire. But Sapphire has two forthcoming books, Found, a collection of poems, and The Kid, which she describes as a coming-of-age novel. It's an artist's coming-of-age, a dancer in Harlem, a young man. Sapphire is a courageous and intuitive writer. She combines rawness and subtlety, and she epitomizes George Steiner's dictum that art should make us less capable of passing by. And so, Sapphire, welcome to Los Angeles.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
In the past 2 years, I guess it's been the past 2 years with the...
Okay. How's this? Is that better? Okay. Cool.
With the release of the film, Precious, you've been traveling to Los Angeles more. Yeah. So I just wanted to kick off the conversation with talking about what it's like to be back here.
Well, it's been a long time since I've lived in Los Angeles. So the Los Angeles that I'm seeing now is not the Los Angeles, of course, that I grew up in, which was a place of a lot of pain and poverty. And this Los Angeles is high rises and beauty and beautiful architecture where you live downtown and everything. So the Los Angeles that I grew up in was burning. You know, Watts was burning. I remember the battles between the Black Panthers and Ron Karanga's Us, and just it was just a very different Los Angeles, very stratified by race and class. And if there was, and I know, now I know that there was, if there was a movement of artists and intellectuals, I didn't know them. You know, I didn't know them. And so it was to find out and to become who I wanted to become, I needed to leave.
Mm-hmm. And with the journey that the book took, that the book Push took to becoming the film, and I know it was entrusting Push and entrusting mm-hmm. Precious mm-hmm. to Lee Daniels, and he made this brilliant film, and you have these extraordinary actresses. Mm-hmm. What was that process like as a writer who had lived with this book and refused the rights to many people wanted to make a film of this book, but you're
yeah. Yeah. So many people had approached me, and it wasn't that I would just refuse these people. I would actually interview them, and I remember, and I would really try to pay attention to when African-Americans would come to me, and I really thought I was going to go someplace with one guy, I don't remember him, but he's an African-American young filmmaker. Why not give these people a chance? And he told me, you know, don't worry, Sapphire. I've already got Brandy lined up. Oh, my God. I got to get out of here. I said, dude, I got to go. And give me your card, and I'll be back at you. So people were serious, but we weren't on, as we say, the same page. You know what I mean? And so at some point, I just got tired of talking to people. And Lee had actually approached me before he had done Monsters Ball. So after talking to people and hearing things like I've got, you know, got Brandy lined up, I started to only talk to people who would send me, DVDs weren't out then, but, you know, videos of, let me see what you've done, and if you've done something that's even halfway credible, I will talk with you. And so when I met Lee, he hadn't done anything. He just had a whole bunch of ideas and everything, and he just kept after me, and I was talking with someone else, and he was calling my agent talking about is she still negotiating with so and so, and then he went on about his business, and his business turned out to be Monsters Ball. And so I remember he called my agent and said, I want Sapphire to come see Monsters Ball. And I, you know, by this time I said, I am so through with dude. And so I did not go see Monsters Ball. And then I was walking down Broadway in Manhattan, I Pastor Marquis, and I says, Monster's Ball. I said, well, let me go see what the homeboy is putting down, you know what I mean? So I went on in there, paid my $10, and saw Monster's Ball, and I'm in the middle of it, and I'm saying, oh, I told this dude no, oh, my God, you know what I mean? Oh, shit, you know? And then, fortunately, he called me again with Shadow Boxer, and he invited me for a screening of Shadow Boxer. And after I saw that, I said, you know, I'm good to go. And so he, in neither of the films dealt with any of the material that I'm dealing with, but what they showed me was that this was someone who wasn't afraid, you know. So Monster's Ball, what do we have? A black woman who's hanging out with a white boy who's helped execute her husband. And I said, uh-oh, you know, he's not. Shadow Boxer, what is that? A white woman who is a serial killer who has killed a boy's parents and takes the boy home, raises him, and becomes his lover. So I said, well, obviously he's not afraid. He's not afraid. He's not afraid to approach certain material. And he would do this, you know. He would not, as we saw, if you saw the film, he would not back away from this material. And so then we just started to collaborate and move forward.
And when you first met him, did you have an intuitive hit for him, or?
No, when I first met him, it was like, would you get him out of here? You know, when he was first come, it wasn't until, it was when I saw his work, and then I thought, oh, he did that? And I said, we can talk. But no, when I first met him, it was really like, I wasn't feeling him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, I'm comfortable with that, because Hollywood is full of very charismatic people who know how to get what they want and have a glib, fast game and talk a lot, you know what I mean? So I really would ask these people, show me, you know, because you're not coming to me because I'm cute. You're coming to me because you read some material that you think you can make something out of. And so show me what you can do, you know what I mean? And yeah, wanted to see the quality of his work. And he couldn't show me that in the beginning. And then I saw something that he produced and I saw something that he directed and I said, well, I'm good to go.
And he was so passionate about the book and so passionate about Precious. And one thing we just, we read the book in one of our classes at USC, and we were looking at the novel primarily, not the film, and looking at the novel. And one thing that's so amazing is how much more of Precious you get in the novel, because you get that first person. And one thing that my students marveled over, and I know you're a student of Dostoevsky, is that ability to go to that place through the first person. And I wondered if you might talk about that. Was that a matter of the voice coming to you? Was it a decision, or was it just the way that you heard her?
Well, it's interesting you talk about Dostoevsky and also Dickens early as socially conscious novelists. But they, with the exception of David Copperfield, most of Dickens' books were written in the third person, and the same with Dostoevsky. And I think it was Ernest Gaines who said, this is what American novelists bring to literature, is the first person. Why, I don't know why we can do it, you know what I mean? But we do it, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, so it was that wanting to approach the social issues, you know, like I had seen in Crime and Punishment, like I had seen in The Color Purple, but really wanting to do it in the first person and through the voice of this girl, and really, and I think as a black woman being really committed to what Toni Morrison talking about in The Bluest Eye, the character who had not been written, the character that I wanted to see. So I wanted to see Precious Jones. I wanted to see these young women who I had taught, who I hadn't seen reflected in literature. And the way to it, for me, because I'm not a person who can go on and, like, if you read James Baldwin's novels of Harlem, you're going to get pictures of 125th Street and the river and everything. And so for me as a poet, I was functioning through the voice a lot, through the word. And I really wanted to bring forth Precious's voice. And I thought if we heard her voice, we would then see her. Mm-hmm. If we, instead of describing her, have her see herself, mm-hmm. have her describe how she looks to her reader, you know what I mean?
And one thing we were talking about earlier is that it's not a makeover book. It's not. Precious starts the book at 300 pounds, and by the end, she's joined Jenny Craig, and she's beautiful, right. And she's found the man,
It's all better.
One point when we were marketing the book and I was talking to different editors, I talked to an editor at St. Martin's Press, and she said, you know, we really like what you've got here, but what, you know, you don't think it would be possible for her to, toward the end, to lose weight and find a boyfriend, you know what I mean? And I said, that is what's called a romance novel, and that is not exactly what I'm writing, and you already have that, you know, the world already has that. We already have enough Cinderella stories, so I wanted to write a story of a young woman who... And even in a certain kind of way, The Color Purple is a Cinderella story, but it's a gay Cinderella story. So I really wanted, well, what happens to, evidently, the vast majority of African-American women are not married, you know? I mean, most of the men are in prison or not suitable mates or whatever, so a lot of African-American women have to live their lives alone. Is her life not worth living? Because she asked in the book, well, where's my man love? Where's my woman love? Where's my any kind of love? And what Precious has to satisfy herself with is the loving herself and knowing that she's a worthy person.
And that journey that she takes, like this line I love, she's so funny. Last time they want to weigh me at school, I say no. Why for? I know I'm fat, so what? Next topic for the day. So part of that is the coming to language.
Exactly.
And then, and that's something that's shown in the film, but not like, you can't go into it in the way on film because it's
Well, what the film does is that in some ways that the book couldn't do, it gives us a powerful, with Gabourey Sidibe, a powerful visual picture of a girl. Mm-hmm. And then we see her fantasies, which Lee was, you know, we see her fantasies. We see her look in the mirror and see this blonde woman. I mean, when I first saw that, it just took my breath away, you know, and I
but
wrote
it. It's in the book.
But I think those things he does in the film are even more graphic, and they're powerful.
Yeah.
I think there's some things that the book does better, but there's some things that as a filmmaker he was able to do that the book couldn't do, and I give him, you know, that's what makes, I think, a great film, is that it's more than the book, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And he, and in some ways it was less, but in some ways it was more, and that's what makes it so powerful.
And that's why people are going back to the book. That's why it's been on the bestseller list for six months.
Yeah, so there's also issues in the book that the film can never touch, because of who he is as his own place in time as a political and social and artistic entity. It's not the same as who I was, and his agenda was different. I was trying to make an experience that people could, even fast readers, it's going to take 24 hours to read a book like Push. I mean, there are people who can sit down and read it in one day. Most people will take a week or a week to read the book, put it down. He had to make an experience that was going to be 90 minutes. The viewer is going to walk in. If they walk out, that's the end. That's the end of it. So for me, I knew there were parts in the novel that were tough. You put them down, call your therapist, and come back and read again. You know what I mean? But if he lost people, if he created scenarios that were too intense or too violent or too repulsive in a certain kind of way, people walk out and that's the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
End of the experience. So he had his mission, the filmmaker's job, unless they are, you know, living in some place that is totally state-financed or whatever, you know what I mean? But his issue was much different than mine, and I think he fulfilled his dream with
one thing you mentioned, and it's such an amazing film, but one thing that you mentioned was that the Each One Teach One girls wrote essays.
Yeah, they were really amazing young women. They wrote essays about, you know, how they saw the character. They interviewed me, of course, because they were young women, so they knew the world, but they didn't know that world. And they were, I thought they were magnificent, you know what I mean? I loved them in the film. I thought they gave a certain kind of levity and reality that the film really, really needed.
And it showed that her journey was from the self and from the self-loathing to, like, seeing herself reflected in their eyes and how much they love her,
exactly.
And then going to, as she calls it, the insect survivor group, which
exactly.
is left out of the film. But
yeah.
You know, so
I think
you
it's
get
in
this...
the DVD. So again, he has 90 minutes. So there were some scenes, I haven't even seen that scene myself, but he told me, you know, as he was shooting, the different scenes he was shooting, and he shot a lot of things that were in the book that ended up not being in the movie, just in terms of getting I think that the movie is 90 minutes or 109 minutes. So that scene was left out. And again, I mean, and there were scenes like the scene in the beginning where she actually gives birth to the baby, you know, we didn't want an X-rated film. What's the point in an X-rated film if the kids can't come see it? You know what I mean? So if we had the birth scene and the baby coming out the vagina, well, automatically that's nudity. And then you had an X-rated film, and the kids got to show ID before they can get in the theater. You know what I mean? So there were a lot of choices that he made, and I think they were intelligent choices.
And just going back to that idea about being visible and being invisible, and you do get those visual hits of Precious in the film, and I wondered if you might read, just thinking about this, the passage that where she talks about being invisible or feeling invisible.
So this is actually a passage where she has taken the test, and prior to going to school, she fails all of her tests, and she says, "For me, this is nothing new. There's always been something wrong with the Tesses. The Tesses paint a picture of me with no brain. The Tesses paint a picture of me and my mother, my whole family. We more than dumb. We invisible. One time I seen us on TV. It was a show of spooky shit and castles, you know, all that shit be haunted. And the peoples, well, some of them was peoples and some of them was vampire peoples. But the real peoples did not know it till it was party time. You know, it was crackers, they was eating their roast turkey and drinking champagne and shit. So it's five of them sitting on the couch and one of them get up and take a picture, got it? When picture develop is instamatic, only one picture on the couch. The other peoples did not exist. They vampires. They eats, drinks, wear clothes, talks, and fucks. But stuff, when you get right down to it, they don't exist."
And even, you know, in the very early passages in the book, before she has the certain types of grammar down, and she just this word joy, right, and this image joy that she has, and you feel like she is a poet and she's susceptible and vulnerable to language, and that sensitivity brings her towards that yearning, and just the relationship with the alphabet, right, that she develops.
I think it's important to know, you know, this book is also written in about the late 80s and the early 90s. So we're dealing with a time in the 80s, a time when African American youth will transform American culture with hip hop and rap. So, and this is a verbal linguistic game that is going to change the world. You know, I would go to Sweden and people are doing rap. You know, France, people are doing hip hop and everything. And this is was coming from the least educated and by some people's mind, the least literate segment of society is taking and using language to express what this culture is all about. And so that idea that language belongs to the literate, well, no, language is a part of all of our lives, whether we are, in the upper echelon of kicking it, you know, or whether we're down on the street kicking it, it's all language. And Precious is as entranced by language as a PhD at Oxford. You know, she understands that language defines her. And if she is going to redefine her existence, she needs language to do it.
I love when she's reading The Color Purple to Abdul at the end. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I wondered if you might read this passage. Oh, there's something else I want to ask you about her relationship with Farrakhan, her like... But let's okay. Look at this. So it's the bottom of 63.
So this is, at this point, she's pregnant with Abdul, and she's just kind of sitting and resting, and she says, "I put my hand on my stomach. I sit here and rest a while before Mama called me to fix dinner or clean up. It's 26 letters in the alphabet, Each letter got sound. Put sound to letters, mix letters together, and you got words. You got words. Baby, start with B. B for baby, I says in nice, soft voice. Soon as he get born, I'm gonna start doing the ABCs. This is my baby. My mother took little Mongo, but she ain't taking this one. I am competent. I am competent to take care of my baby. I was competent enough for her husband to fuck. She ain't coming here and say, call Kenwood Jones, that's wrong. Get off Precious. Can't you see Precious as a beautiful child, like White Child in magazines or on toilet paper wrapper? Precious is a blue-eyed, skinny child whose hair is long braids. Get off Precious, fool. It's time for Precious to go to the gym like Janet Jackson. It's time for Precious' hair to be braided. Get off my child, nigga. No, she never say that. Miss Rain say value. Values determine how we live as much as money do. I say, Miss Rain, stupid there. All I can think about is she don't know what it's like to have nothing. Never breathe and wait for the check. Check late, you cry. Check important, most important. My mama not getting no check for me. I think she be done killed me a long time ago. Well, maybe not kill me, but that's how I feel. Miss Rain say feelings is important. White woman on the news leave her daddy in the desert in a wheelchair when the checks run out. He had that Alzheimer disease, and bitch leave him under a cactus tree with a teddy bear. Don't tell me nothing about checks ain't important. Mama say this new school ain't shit. Say you can't learn nothing writing in no book. You got to get on that computer. You want some money. When they going to teach you how to do the computer? But Mama wrong. I is learning. I going to start going to family literacy class. It's important to read to your baby after it's been born. Important to have colors hanging from the wall. Listen, baby. I puts my hand on my stomach. I breathe deep. Listen, baby, I writes in my notebook. A is for Africa. B is for you, baby. C is colored. We black. D is dog. E is evil like mama. F is fuck. G is Jermaine. No, but Jermaine is J. Okay, G is gun. H is home. I is somebody. J is Jermaine. K is kill. L is love. M is Farrakhan, who is a real man, M. N is North America. America equal KKK. O is open. P is punks. Q is Queen Latifah. R is respect. S is stop. T is two-ton. V is vote. W is well. X is main man Malcolm. Z is zonk, mean like high. Listen, baby. Mother love you. Mother not dumb. Listen, baby. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, Z. That's the alphabet. 26 letters in all. Them letters make up words. Them words, everything.
Having a conversation in class about this, and Amy Gerstler was talking about her collection of alphabet books, and that there was... This was one of the best alphabet books she'd ever seen. And you cite some of your influences through Precious, Alice Walker and Lucille Clifton.
Exactly. So Lucille Clifton, who passed away a few months ago, was just really an important poetic influence. And she had a book called The Black BCs. And so that in I forget the, but A is for Africa, you know, it's just a beautiful book, out of print, of course, but probably available right here. Yeah. But that becomes kind of almost the narrative strength of this text will be the word, and the word symbolized by the alphabet. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, what you see is there's a moment where Precious is traumatized and she's running down the subway and she starts to recite the alphabet to herself, kind of like a mantra, just kind of to center A, B, C, D. But that is that this language that has defined her as a vampire, as something that defines all poor people in a capitalist society, that we're vampires who basically are here to suck the blood of the system. Mm-hmm. And that we don't have a right to life. And this, and you know, as we enter into a population that ages, I think even rich white people are finding out once they retire and are no longer seen as contributors, that, you know, and that they need their medical help and this and that. Once you're not contributing to a culture that defines itself around money, then you're seen again as a vampire, something sucking the blood of the system, and no one wants to pay your Social Security. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that whole thing of how we define, as Ms. Rain said, what are our values? Mm-hmm. What is important? Is it just money? Or is human life only worth something when it has something to give? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? What is important here?
And the way that Precious starts finding out what's important, talking to herself and discovering
exactly.
When she loves Ms. Rain, but she resists her on Farrakhan.
Right, exactly.
Although she understands what she's saying, but she doesn't totally filter out her,
exactly.
her understanding.
Well, she doesn't filter out her view of the world. Mm-hmm. So for her, Farrakhan is not a racist. Farrakhan is not an anti-Semite. He is an African-American man who has said the family is important. She is from a destroyed family. She's from a destroyed family. So she's looking for influences that can help her put together her life again. And that's the reason why many people who are not born into fundamentalist cultures, whether it's a fundamentalist Christianity, fundamentalist Judaism, fundamentalist Islamic culture, young, we wonder, well, why are these young women putting on the veil? Well, you've fucking bombed their village. They have no place to go, so they turn to the most reactionary aspects of their own culture to try to hold on to their life. You know what I mean? So she has nothing. You know what I mean? And so when she looks around her for something that could be positive, she doesn't see it through. She doesn't see fundamentalist religion through the eyes of the middle class. Mm-hmm. She sees it through the eyes of the underclass, and it can give her something. So, a fundamentalist Christian, Jewish, Islamic religion would take from me. It would take from me. I have a certain amount of freedom, autonomy, and to go in to have to cover my body or to adhere to certain rules would infringe upon what I already have. So suppose you have nothing. That culture is going to offer you shelter. It's going to offer you protection, even though all of a sudden you're in a world where men ostensibly respect women. You know, your freedom from a certain kind of humiliation. You know, not having to go down to welfare and beg anymore. So yeah, those called that. We have to look at what is being when we, you know, why are women doing this? Why not? What did feminism ever do for Precious?
Mm-hmm. And that's something that Ms. Rain, when she talks about Farrakhan's homophobia, mm-hmm. And she sort of, you know, this is like such news to Precious, and Precious
exactly.
meets the butch girl in her class, and suddenly her world tilts, and you see how open she is.
Yeah, so she has certain ideas, and so in some ways there is a fairy tale aspect to Precious in that she's the prince who is not the princess, she's the prince who's going to have to slay certain dragons to get what she wants. So her dragons will be her own narrow-mindedness. So these are... So Farrakhan is a presence on a video. Janet Jackson and them are presences on videos. These are all of her heroes, but they're not in her world. So the people who can transform her world are Ms. Rain and her classmates who are Hispanic and Jamaican and just, you know, foreigners. You know, she just doesn't understand why she's in school with people who were not born in America. And but these are going to be the people who are going to heal her and offer her love and offer her a way out of the hell that is her present existence. And some people turn their back on life and go back to what they've known rather than deal with something that's different. But Precious, somewhere along the line, decides that, you know, well, the coconut heads, the Jamaicans, they're not so bad. You know, I think I can hang here. And Rita Romero has turned out to be a mother to me. And Miss Rain is the one who gave me language, who made me queen of the ABCs. So her experience, she's willing to challenge her own perceptions against what she's experiencing, and she decides to go with it.
And what's expected of her.
Exactly.
You know, like the low bar, like when she snatches the social worker's file, you know, and there's so many things that she does that are so Oliver Twist-like, you know, she's just mm-hmm. like...
Well, in snatching the social worker's file, this is the language that's been used against her. So anyone who's had to deal with social services knows that you become totally objectified, and the social worker has a program for her that is not about her ultimate fulfillment. It's about her getting off of welfare, which is the goal, which is what Reagan, Bush, Clinton, these people, it was not what's best for these young women. It's what's best for the people who are doling out the money, and the best thing is for them to get off welfare as soon as possible. Rudolph Giuliani in New York was bragging about how many people he had kicked off welfare. So she takes the file back. What the dossier that the state has on her, she steals it, and it's through that she finds out that they have plans for her that don't have anything to do with her advancement. They want her to go be a home attendant, mm-hmm. and she's started to dream. Miss Rain has given her these dreams and in some ways taught her to dream but didn't give her the tools to mm-hmm. to really enact the dream. And it's through her own savvy that she finds out that they want her to really to cut her education short and become a servant.
And that dream, it's like that the night she spends in Langston Hughes's house, which isn't in the movie, but there's a night that she spends.
She's homeless, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like that's her shelter.
Exactly.
And that's where she goes, and that's where... Mm-hmm. It's almost through this kind of osmosis, through language and through literacy and through the writers who have shown her other ways of being and shown her that she's participating in the reading that she's doing.
That yeah, it's through reading and through writing that she becomes a participant in her culture mm-hmm. and that she sees others who are like her mm-hmm. and that she has the tools to... I mean, you have to remember, we're part of African-Americans' condition is that we, Thomas Jefferson, justified slavery by defining African-Americans as three-fifths human. That therefore that would justify slavery because we were basically animals. And, you know, we use technical definitions of people to justify oppression. I mean, the whole immigration thing, you know, part of what people in New York at least say, well, how can a human being be illegal? What is an alien? You know what I mean? But the language is used, so if you can call someone an illegal alien, then that justifies having them work in a restaurant for 16 hours a day for $15, you know? And you'll hear people say, well, in Mexico, they'd only be getting five. So we use the language of illegal alien to justify basically a certain kind of almost indentured servitude, you know? And so she has this language of being a welfare recipient, of being poor, of being obese, of being illiterate. Those labels have justified the state through has participated in her abuse in a certain kind of way. It's not just mama, you know what I mean? I mean, what has happened to her over 17, 18 years would not have been allowed to happen to an upper middle class white child. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they were abused, they're not going to go through 17 years of schooling not being able to read or write. Mm-hmm. So some of this has been state participation in her abuse, and the state has looked at her and decided that she was not worth anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so little follow-up sometimes, and with the students, when we both worked in the schools in New York, and when you know that their needs aren't being met at home, but it's a large thing. One thing that really struck me is she's in the incest survivors group, and her hand shoots up, almost like beyond her will, mm-hmm. and that's an action out of like this interior change. And one thing really struck me in rereading the novel this time is the way that she talks about the color purple and loving the color purple, and Ms. Rain's interpretation of some of the criticism about the color purple. And I thought this was particularly ironic and interesting considering the recent letter to the editor, or the op-ed piece that retired poetry professor Ishmael Reed sent concerning Precious. And I wondered if you might read this passage.
Okay, so turn that off. Okay. All right. Things going good in my life, almost like the color purple. Abdul is 9 months old, and you know my baby is walking. He's smart, smart. I've been reading to him since the day he was born. I love The Color Purple. That book gave me so much strength. Miss Rain say a group of black men wanted to stop the movie from the book. Say it's an unfair picture of nigger men. She asked me, what do I think? Unfair picture? Unfortunately, it is a picture I know, except, of course, Farrakhan, who is a real man. But I never seen him except on the videos. Now, he say problem is not crack, but the cracker. I go for that. Miss Rain say one of the criticisms of The Color Purple is it have a fairy tale ending. Well, I would say shit like that can be true. Life can work out for the best sometimes. Miss Rain loved The Color Purple too, but she say realism has its place. Ism, smism. Sometimes I want to tell Miss Rain, shut up with all the ism stuff. But she my teacher, so I don't tell her to shut up. I don't know what realism mean, but I do know what reality is. And it's a motherfucker, let me tell you.
So what struck me as ironic,
right,
was, you know, that Ms. Rain sharing with her the reality of the political situation behind who owns the power to have these novels made into films, which will reach a lot of people. And that's why it seemed to me such a miracle that Push was transformed into this amazing film. Mm-hmm. And when you saw that op-ed piece do you guys know this op-ed piece, Ishmael Reed?
Mm-hmm.
What was it titled, Fade to White?
Yeah, Fade to White. And some of the points, you know, it's the same old horse he's been beating for 20 years. I mean, you know, the first time I heard about the piece, Bob Holman, who's used to run the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, now the Bowery Poetry Cafe, said, you know, Ishmael Reed is taking you on now. And I said, well, good, you know, because everybody he hates, check out his hate list. Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Jamaica Kincaid. I said, I've arrived. He hates me now. He didn't even know I existed. Cool, you know. So it wasn't a big thing. But the attack in the New York Times came right after Precious had been nominated for the Oscar, and it was really one of the things he tried to say was that the Academy was pandering to this negative view of black men, and you know, it was boring. But I usually don't respond to that. You know, I don't usually write letters to the editor, but I did respond to his op-ed piece because I thought it's no longer about me. You know, the book is out there. But these are these young actors. Steven Spielberg didn't do Precious. This was done by a young African-American man from a working-class background from Philadelphia who this was privately funded. I mean, he raised the money. He got out and got Hollywood didn't give us this money. This was not, you know, he got out and got the money to do this film and did it without compromise. You know what I mean? And I just felt that the young actors in the film, the Each One Teach One Girls Precious, these were not movie stars. These were people who had never been in a film before. This was a breakout film for these young women. And I just felt his criticism was unfair. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you wrote a letter in response, mm-hmm. but the New York Times edited it down.
Yeah.
I actually have a copy of your unedited letter. Would you want to read parts of it?
So I think I'm just, what I'll do is kind of raise my hand to show you the parts that they edited out. So this is, and his article was called Some Thoughts on Fade to White. Some thoughts, I mean, his article was Fade to White, and this, my response, was Some Thoughts on Fade to White. In the past 13 years since my novel Push has been published, I have talked to thousands of women who have been sexually abused, some of whom have had experiences that make what happened in Push, which was made into the film Precious, look like a walk in the park. I am not a social scientist, but a creative artist. I took and will continue to take the stories of women I have listened to and turn them into fiction. I write about black women because it's the world I know. Fade to White mentions that incest is not confined to one group of people. I agree, but I argue that it does have a different place in African American culture than it has in white culture. During slavery, many black women were impregnated by their masters and who were often also their fathers. The white male was literally the master father of the plantation. None of this was in there. He had sex with who he wanted to, black women, children, and men. This was the family structure most slaves were exposed to. Black men were not allowed to act out the role of the father. They themselves were raped like women, in addition to being turned into stud-like breeders. We, as a race, have yet to deal with the fact that black men were raped like bitches during slavery, nor have we dealt with the impact that that has had on the generations of us that came out of slavery. I would like to see black males less defensive and more courageous in their investigations of sexual abuse in the black community. I would like to see more, not less, written about rape by African Americans. Mr. Reed blames a lot on the white man. None of this was in there, of course. But there is one thing we cannot hide from or blame on the white man or his media. We have the highest rate of heterosexual HIV infection in the United States. More heterosexual black males have HIV than any other group of men in this country. While the effects of sexual abuse are traumatic for any group of women, black women more often than any other ethnic group must deal with being infected with HIV by our perpetrators. While incest happens in all cultures, it impacts African American culture in ways it does not impact other cultures. All the shame, denial, and ranting by fools like Mr. Reed will not change that one day in the early 1990s, an HIV-positive student of my, African-American student of mine told me, I had a baby by my father when I was 12, and she, that baby, got Down syndrome. Silence will not save African-Americans. We've got to work hard and long, and our work begins by telling our stories out loud to whoever has the courage to listen. And if you go online, you can find the edit, the what they printed, what they mm-hmm. actually printed.
Mm-hmm. It's
much and his shorter. And his and his stupid response. I guess what would be interesting, you know, and I didn't say that in the letter or anything, but to really look at this man who used to be a talented artist, who around 25 years ago, just got, you know, read Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and just fell down and had a heart attack. And stopped his own career and has spent the past 25 years attacking black women. And what the fuck has he done? And since, you know, he wrote some shit in the 60s, and he hasn't done anything since, you know, but run around attacking black women. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd, you know. But it's like some type of obsession, you know what I mean? Did we spend 25 years talking about Richard Wright just because he had Bessie beaten with a rock? You know what I mean? We just felt, okay, you have a right to write what you want. You know, black men have created portraits of African-American women that are no more favorable than what white people have created, and we didn't do anything but go out and write our own books. You know, we said, okay, that's how you see us. Now we're going to write how we see ourselves. You know what I mean?
So when you lift the self-censorship, that's when the people come down on you.
Exactly.
And one thing you say in the letter, silence will not save African Americans. And we've got to work hard and long, and our work begins by telling our stories out loud to whoever has the courage to listen. And that reminds me of the passage where she is going to, I think it's her first incest survivor meeting.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I know the film had to stop at a certain point. But for me, for this reader, mm-hmm. that incest survivor group seemed like the turning point where mm-hmm. it was no longer, I mean, it was still about Precious, but it was also about the women in the group. And that's when she you know, came into this awareness of the world. And she had always loved Abdul, but now it was like, you know, her heart cracked open in a different
exactly,
way.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so I'm thinking a lot of, we actually talked about this last night, one of the kind of pivotal thinkers, I think, in the 1980s was a psychiatrist at, I think she's at Harvard, actually, Judith Herman, who wrote a book on the psychology of a survivor. And one of the things she says is that an important point in any person's who has suffered anything is the breaking of the isolation and realizing that others have suffered too. Mm-hmm. So, you know how boring it can be to be around someone who is just trapped in their own victimization, you know what I mean? And, you know, you listen to it for a year or two and then you get tired. So anyone whose intellectual and emotional repertoire is not analyzing what happened to them, whether it's slavery or the Holocaust or something, but they're trapped in it, you know what I mean? And then they become champions of their own victimization. No one has suffered as much as we have. Who has ever suffered slavery? Who has ever, whoever suffered their whole, my whole tribe was wiped out. You know, we used to own the whole Southwest of America or whatever, you know, but but part of it is understanding that we have all suffered. We've all suffered. You know, the population of Africa was decimated during the slave trade. You know, we all know what the Holocaust of Europe. You know, this land was peopled by another people when Christopher Columbus set his little nasty foot here. You know what I mean? So we have all suffered. And if we remain trapped in our own victimization, we don't see the connection between us. We settle for victimhood as opposed to that we are survivors who have suffered, and that suffering is a human condition, and that we overcome it. You know what I mean? And so that's what happens mm-hmm. for her in this mm-hmm. passage that got cut out the movie. So,
but it's on the DVD.
But it's evidently on the DVD.
We think
we haven't. We tried to watch the DVD. I'm so behind the times. So we bought the fucking Blu-ray. So they've got you with this stuff. You go out and buy the stuff. Then you have to buy a whole new entertainment system to watch it. You know what I mean? So we weren't able to see if it was in there. But here she's arriving at the she's arriving at the meeting, and the meeting, of course, like most group therapy meetings, is in a circle. So the hierarchy is broken down. When I get to the meeting, I don't say nothing. It's people sitting in a circle. I'm supposed to talk. Honey, I will never talk in here. To talk, I have to tell how I feel in my body, the war, my body, my head, my body, my head. I can't say it right. How come I'm so young and feel so old? So young, like I don't know nothing. So old, like I know everything. A girl have her father's dick in her mouth, know things the other girls don't know, but that's not what you want to know. It's all kind of girls here. They sitting in circle, faces like clocks, no bombs. Bombs with hair and titties and dresses. After I sit here 5 minutes, I know I am a bomb too. Only sitting here doing whatever they gonna do will keep me from blowing up. Thank you, Rita Romero, for getting me here on time. "Hello," say a girl. Shit, she looked like a movie star. Slim, long hair, eyes like stars, red lips. "My name is Irene. I am an incest survivor. My mouth fall open." Someone like that. "It started when I was, around 4 or 5 years old with him fondling." That means feeling her up. "By the time I was 12, he was having intercourse with me 3 or 4 times a week. Everything is floating around me now like geese from the lake. I see wings beating, hear geese. It's like birds. Where so many birds come from? I feel like I'm flying. I am flying far up. My body is down in the circle, but precious is a bird flying away. But somebody is holding my hand. It's Rita. She massaged my hand. I come back from being a bird to hear a beautiful girl crying. I smell mama. I feel daddy the way his knees on either side of my neck. Girl say, 'Thank you for letting me share.' She say, 'This is a Tuesday night beginners meeting. To share, raise your hand.' I raise my hand. My hand is going up through the smell of mama. My hand is pushing daddy's dick out my face. I was raped by my father and beat. No one is talking except me. Mama pushed my head down in her, 'I can't talk no more.' Beautiful girl whispered to me, 'Are you through?' I say, 'Yes.' She say, 'Pick the next person.' I look up from my shoes, Nikes, I always wear Nikes. Girls got their hands up. I pick a girl in overalls with blue eyes, grab Rita's hand, listen. Listen to girl raped by her brother. Listen to old woman raped by her father. Don't remember till he died when she is 65 years old. It's girls, it's old women, it's white women, a lot of white women. Girls, younger sister murdered by the cult. A Jewish girl say we had money on Long Island. That's like Westchester. My father was a prominent child psychiatrist, but it started when I was 9 years old. Girls like Jermaine is. Girls say, 'I'm a proud lesbian, but that's the only thing I'm proud of. I was confined to a mental institution for 14 years, diagnosed with schizophrenia.' What am I hearing? 1.5 hours women talk. Can this be done happen to so many women? I know I'm not lying, but is these bitches? Talking about the cult. I thought the cult was in a movie. What kind of world is this where babies rape? A father break a girl's arm, sweet talk you to suck his dick. All kind of girls here, princess girls, fat girls, old women, young women. One thing we got in common, no, the thing we got in common is we was raped."
So the ending in the film is not quite the ending in the book. And there's a kind of acceptance and rest that she comes.
Right.
And that love of Abdul that sort of transforms. There's a sentence in the book, Abdul school, and that running together. But this final image and then or paragraph, and then we'll open it up to the audience, but for your questions, but I just wanted to end with you reading us this last image of Seth of Precious, and then there are these essays, but the essays are they feel like they're in a parallel universe, mm-hmm. and they give you like splices
of the girls' lives.
Of the girls, but it's this last paragraph, Sapphire. It's Sunday.
Okay. It's Sunday. No school. Meetings. I'm in day room at Advancement House, sitting on a big leather stool holding Abdul. The sun is coming through the window, splashing down on him on the pages of his book. It's called The Black BCs. I love to hold him on my lap, open up the world to him. When the sun shine on him like this, he is my angel child, brown sunshine, and my heart feel hurt. 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, maybe more if I take care of myself. Maybe a cure. Who knows who is working on shit like that? Look, his nose is so shiny, his eyes shiny. He is my shiny brown boy. In his beauty, I see my own. He pull on my earring, want me to stop daydreaming and read him a story before nap time.
and I do.
So now we're bringing up the house lights, and I know there must be some questions out there. And let's see. Is there a microphone?
There's a microphone, so raise your hand, and the microphone will come to you.
Can you call people? Yes, yes. Over here, the young man in the pink shirt.
All right. First off, thank you so much for coming. This is really great.
Thank you.
Forgive me if I word this improperly, but one thing I noticed with certain books, with certain movies and whatnot that have African-American main characters and what, they end up being like a black book or a black movie, and only black people really get to see that story. You talk a lot about the invisibility, how she felt invisible, and I feel that with those types of books, you also get this idea that this story is invisible to all these different cultures, all these different races. Why do you think... the story of Precious, like, why is this such a big story to everyone? The Precious movie, more than black people went to go see it. Why do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, that happened, that started to happen in really way before the movie in 1996. So Push has been translated into 18 languages, you know, Hebrew, Croatian, Japanese, Chinese. So something in this story about this young woman coming into language appealed to a lot of different people. And the movie, the experience that I remember is being at Sundance, and they showed the movie twice. It had two screenings, and one was actually in kind of in the little village that is kind of like the Sundance-y part, you know what I mean? And that was kind of industry people and people in the know and you know, people who kind of had some idea of what the movie was going to be about. And then the second screening was in Salt Lake City. And the audience was maybe 90% white, and of the whites, I would say 90% of that 90% were Mormons. And I remember after we showed the film, I didn't know what was happening. And then we, you know, it was a minute. Then the lights came up, and the people gave us a standing ovation. And then then we had Q&A, and a white woman. She had to have been in her 70s or something, or late 70s, 80, stood up and said, "I am Precious. That is my story too." So I think, you know, that's why. There's something about the experience that resonates with many people. And because she's a character who, in a realistic way, triumphs, it enables people. So if she had died at the end of the film, I don't think that same woman would have stood up and said, "I am Precious." So what she was identifying was the spirit of the child, but also that the child was a survivor. And what she's saying is, "I too went through that." You know what I mean? And people seek validation in literature and movies for their own life experiences, I think.
Next question. Right here in the front row.
Hey, Sapphire.
Hey, Dorothy.
How you doing?
I'm good.
You have had such a career as a phenomenal dancer, performer, writer, and activist. What keeps you going? What fuels you? What inspires you? What makes you keep on writing and telling the truth the way you do, no matter what? Mm-hmm. What is it that gets you going from day to day?
Mm-hmm. I think early on, because I've always had so much criticism for some reason or another, is that I learned to affirm myself. So it's wonderful, you know, that when the house is for you and the reviews are coming your way and stuff like that. But a whole lot of people stop the whole game when nothing's happening, you know what I mean, or when no one's paying any attention to them. So I think the first thing I learned to do was that I was doing this for myself. That I would write the books if nobody read them, you know what I mean? I would just do the Emily Dickinson, just put it in a drawer and do it, and that would that made me happy. So that is what has allowed me to sustain myself over the years in some way. And then there's a reality that, but that isn't how it turned out. You know what I mean? I've been just really, really blessed. I mean, I think there's many people who literally psychologically starve because of a lack of an audience. You know what I mean? You know, how long can you paint pictures that no one comes to see? How long can you play your avant-garde music and the club owners don't want you there anymore because no one's buying drinks? You know what I mean? And you don't have a place to play. And so in that way, you know, I've been blessed in that my work has always touched kind of a common thread, you know, and it wasn't so obscure that that people couldn't resonate to it. And so it resonating to many people meant that in some ways it was marketable, and that allowed it to get out. So then I got affirmation, you know, so I will go to Sweden and the young girl will come up and say, "That's my story too." So I get the idea, at least whether it's true or not, that I've tapped into something and that my work has been worthwhile. And so that's, you know, that's luck. We already know there's people who are doing 10 times as much as I'm doing and 10 times better who've committed suicide who've gave up. That's just the throw of the dice in a certain kind of way. It was the hand I was dealt, you know, and I had some hard hands, but I had some good hands, and I played them both. The young woman in the white sweater has had her hand
for a while. It's right there. Hi. Okay, I have two questions. So,
yes, ma'am.
One, I get this a lot. Like, everywhere I go, people always think I'm precious. So do you think I look like her as well?
I think, you know, I don't have my glasses on, baby. To me, you look like a very sweet, beautiful child. A very, very, very sweet, beautiful young woman. I don't know.
Not that that's a bad thing or anything. I'm just wondering.
Okay. Next question.
Okay. What made you want to become a writer? And like, after pursuing dancing, I guess, like, what made you want to transform into becoming a writer?
Well, you can only dance for so long, and you can really write forever unless you get Alzheimer's or just get depressed and give up or something. So I actually thought writing is the most powerful vehicle. I thought it's the most powerful art form in a certain kind of way. For me, you know, for me, I'm not, you know, of course, painter, you know, Van Gogh thought he had the most powerful thing going on, and he did. But, you know, for me, language was really important. And it was also something that I could do without a tremendous amount of money. I could, I was really interested. It was hard to sustain a dance career while working an 8-hour job. It's hard to, I'm interested in art, but it's hard to, you know, to practice art or have oil paints in it or anything like that in a 400 square foot studio. So writing was something that we can all do. You know, you can, you know, buy a tablet, a paper, and a pen, and it was something that I could do. It was an art form that I could practice, and so I pursued it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right there. Tom, and then we have some. I'm going to let you call on people.
You can call it. I'll do this in half of the room and you do
okay,
that half.
Okay.
Precious, I'm curious to know how... Sapphire, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
Sapphire,
okay.
Sorry.
I take no offense. I love Precious.
Precious in my head. Sapphire, I'm curious to know how how you were able to sell this book and get it produced, because the movie obviously came on the success of the book, getting that people interested in it. And I know from it being an aspiring author myself, and I write gritty, dark stuff, it's hard to get people to want to publish something that is disturbing to people as it will be as they read it. I mean, it's touching, but it's not something that people will say.
Right. See, I don't know if I agree with your worldview, because what I'm seeing is nothing is easy. It would be hard for you to get a romance published, but look at No Country for Old Men. Look at Hurt Locker. There is not the same market, you know, that like you know, that I can't think of anybody's name, and it's good I can't think of it, but the market for a certain kind of gritty dark realism is not the same market as you know, Danielle Steele or something like that. But if you're writing good work, I think that it will get published, you know what I mean? And that's the part I would focus on, and that's, as a writer, that's the part you have control over. And that's what I would work on, is getting into print. And the movie thing will either happen or it won't. You don't have any control over that. But getting your work published because your content is disturbing, I don't think that that's as big an issue as it would be 10 or 20 years ago. And I would begin to focus. What I tell students is, look at the writers who you admire. Who published Juno Diaz? Who published David Foster Wallace? You know, look at the publisher. Look, find out who their editors were. Approach people who have published work that you think is on the edge, and they would probably consider publishing your work too. I mean, that's my thought. You know what I mean? And not to walk around with that. No one is gonna take this on because my stuff is too dark. Because it's probably not true. I just was in the airport and bought. It's not that well written. I had to stop the Silence of the Lambs, and it's not even a good. It's not written. It's not. The writing isn't good, you know what I mean? The story I've heard about, but you know what I mean? I'm trying to think of something that I read, Serial Killer, something that was written well, but I didn't find...
Fish,
yeah, that was an excellent book. That's not a serial killer book. But, I mean, so there are books with dark material that are literary books, and then there is kind of crime genre that is... Well, Anne Rule did Green River... The Serial Killer. That's fantastic writing. But the Silence of the Lamb, I wasn't impressed with the writing, so I stopped reading it, you know. I can find other serial killer books, you know.
How hard was it for you to get Push published?
It wasn't hard. It was almost as though there was a big hole in the market. You had had one generation of African American women who had written stellar work, far better than anything I wrote. Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, and these were books based on a Southern reality, often, or semi-rural reality. So there hadn't been any. There wasn't really anyone who was writing a black woman who was writing urban, a story out of an urban America. So it was like the publishers were almost waiting for my voice. That was my experience. I didn't have a hard time. Yeah.
How far you choose?
Okay, this side over here in the turban, yeah.
I wanted to thank you for using Push to push away the veil of silence that so many of us in the human race are subjected to through social conditioning, to believe that we are to live here for other people's expectations, like you going to get the DVD and then finding out you need to buy another piece of equipment to actually view it, and allowing Precious to use her imagination to escape this disempowerment and transform it into her own unique message of hope, you know, and transformation. So I just want to thank you for that.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your comment. Okay. In the blue and white right there, Heather Henry, yeah.
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about your process in actually writing the book.
When I wrote the book, I was in a kind of really... what I call a hothouse environment. So I was in an MFA program. And so, the whole focus of the program, which is writing. So that was, I had a mentor, I had people to share my writing with. I got a not a really a scholarship, but a grant or whatever. So I didn't have to work 8 hours a day anymore. I was at a state school, so my tuition was cheap. My rent was cheap, so I was able to devote a lot of time to the writing, and so it was really not one of those type of discipline things where you get up every morning and you write for an hour for 10 years and there's a novel. So I was in this environment where, you know, just kind of was able to really put in a lot of time in an intense fashion and really get the work done. And by the time I graduated in 95, I was starting to look for a publisher for the book. Okay, your turn.
Okay, green hat.
I would like to know, what is your favorite piece of work that you've written? Poem, prose, anything. What is your favorite piece?
My favorite piece of work that I've written. I think Push. Push. Push has become my favorite. it's the only piece that's paid off. So yeah, it's my favorite. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay,
your turn.
Oh, okay. Way in the back. Okay.
Thank you very much, first of all, for just being you and being honest. I'm a student at SC, and this semester my professor has overwhelmed me with books that I have seen myself in every character. I have been trying to get my BA from USC for 12 years, and a lot of times I had to question myself and say, do I belong in the ghetto that the school sits in, or do I belong in the school? And, you know, education obviously is very important, and I wanted to know, what were your intentions? Precious began to discover herself through ABCs. And so were your intentions to really emphasize the importance of education?
Literacy and language. And I think that education holds a special place for African Americans. We were not a culture who, because of a lot of things, redlining, banks, issues, we were not a culture who came here like a lot of immigrant cultures and came here and started flourishing businesses. So what happened after slavery in Reconstruction is that every effort that African Americans had to establish businesses and to own land was destroyed by the Ku Klux Klan. I remember, you know, trying to explain this to some Jamaican students who were saying, you niggas don't have no businesses here. And I said, yeah, it's true. And I tried to explain how that happened. But the thing that we did have was that we had education. You know, African Americans were not able to go to white schools. That's when the birth of the black colleges began. We started to set up separate, and they were not equal, but separate institutions. And there was a way that we were able to progress through education and getting jobs, even when we could not become merchants. I mean, I think it's interesting that we have an African-American president, you know, the highest office in the land, and we still don't have any African-American equivalent to IBM, Microsoft, because that was just not a way that we were able to establish ourselves. And we still are living in a culture where I would, you know, my young niece, I would tell her to go to Harvard, become a lawyer, and become the first black woman president before I would tell her to, you know, try to start a business, you know what I mean? So for us, I think education holds a very unique place, because we were not able to use money to position ourselves in our culture. By our culture, I mean American culture. And any advancement, for the most part, that we made was through education or entertainment. It wasn't, and we forget, even though we have the world-class entertainers, that the beginning of African-American culture in the United States, we were entertainers and athletes, but we were not acknowledged of it. You know, I mean, you know, they used us, and we could not even appear on stage. They would appear for us in blackface. So even our advent in entertainment is only from the 1950s onward. You know, I mean, before that, you know, we had Elvis Presley instead of Jackie Wilson. We have one more question. Bridget, your call.
Okay, your hand shot up so immediately. Yeah.
I would just like to know how you channel the voice of Precious. Does she speak to you, or do you create her voice?
You know, the New Age thing would be that she speaks to me. Right? You know. But the reality is that, you know, I'm an artist and I create things. And I created her voice. I created her voice, you know what I mean? I'm not a channel. I have no religious affiliations. You know, I don't have dreams. Things don't speak to me or anything like that. You know, I'm a kind of cold, calculated person. I remember then they used to come try to hug me. I said, get the fuck away from me. I'm not a warm, empathic person. I'm an intellectual. I think and I create and I make warm, empathic things on the page.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC, 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.